am here with Karolina Vaxlaviak, who is most recently the author of How to Get into the Twin Palms. Karolina, how are you doing? I hope I have the last name right.
You have it perfect.
Oh,
I'm
wow.
doing really well. Thank you.
Oh, good. So I want to get right down into it. The immediate influence I saw when reading this book was, of course, Before the Law, that whole chapter in the trial, where you have this priest who is sitting there trying to get in and actually study the law in Kafka's The Trial. And I wanted to ask if this might have been an inspiration for Anya, who is also trying to get in, more than living up to your title, into the Twin Palms. What's interesting is that, you know, we're not even certain why Anya wants to get into the Twin Palms. I'm curious, you know, if Kafka might have been an influence and what her version of the law might be.
It's interesting you mention Kafka, because Kafka is pretty much one of my father's favorite writers of all time, and
yeah.
he was always talking about Kafka and Dostoevsky at home, so perhaps subliminally I was influenced by Kafka. He did make my brother read every Kafka book ever written starting at age 8.
But not you?
Not me.
Why? Why do the boys have to read in the house? This is...
Well, I would say a bad kid who just didn't want to do anything my parents said, and if they liked something, I instantly hated it, so,
Did you do the same thing with Dostoevsky, too? Like, no, you're not leaving until you read The Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah, and he gave me, when I was 18, he gave me a Diderot book, and he said, this will explain men to you.
What? Wow. Well, you had quite an interesting upbringing. How on earth did you get a love of books based off of this?
Our house is pretty much all books, and my sister was a huge reader. All of us were huge readers, and my parents are both electrical engineers, but my father was a big dreamer and just loved to read. So we, you know, didn't have a ton of toys, but we had a lot of books.
Yes.
So I grew up reading, and I, strangely, I would read the same book over and over and over again, so I pretty much had, like, as a kid, every Roald Dahl book memorized.
Yeah.
And Chocolate Factory was my favorite because I was just obsessed with a world where food was everywhere. It just seemed amazing to me. So
when did you find out that Roald Dahl was a monster?
I never wanted to believe it.
Oh, I see. You sort of like put your head down. No, he's such a great author. I don't want to know about his life.
I feel like I can separate, you know, who you are as a human and who you are as a writer. And
yeah.
just if you're a really good writer, I'll give you a bit of leeway there.
Wow. Norman Mailer, then.
Yeah, he's the best.
Stabbing his wife. You're doing all sorts of stuff.
That's passion.
What other books did you have growing up in the house that you reread over and over again? I'm curious.
I was really influenced by, like, Madeleine L'Engle and really into fantasy for some reason, although nothing that I write is fantastical at all.
Yeah.
So it was more about just escaping. In other worlds and just finding ways to be anywhere except where I was.
Wait, was it a fairly austere family upbringing which caused this need to escape? Or?
Yeah, I mean, so we immigrated to America in 1981.
Yeah.
And we didn't have anything. I mean, church sponsored us in Texas, and I mean, they bought our groceries for us. We didn't have any pots or pans or anything. I mean, everything from the ground up was from this Catholic church. So
did your family revere Reagan as much
as
I did? I did. I figured that might have been a cool life experience.
Yes. I mean, it was flags on every piece of clothing, basically. And we had, you know, Reagan was the reason we came to America. So Reagan was like,
When were you first skeptical about Reagan, out of curiosity?
I don't know. When I started realizing what was going on.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. A more interesting story. So you came over to America.
Came over to America in 1981, and we just didn't know anyone. In fact, we were supposed to go to Australia. We left Poland sort of middle of the night. Lined in our suitcases were our birth certificates and stuff
that.
I mean, so that whole way out. and went to Austria.
Do you hide now in the present day things in your suitcases? I mean, old habits die hard, I hear, you know.
I know. No, no. We're out in the open. We're naturalized.
Okay.
It's okay.
All right. All right. But, no subterfuge, no evading government authorities,
no,
especially
no.
Oppressive ones. Yeah.
I pay my taxes.
Okay.
So, we were in Austria, and we were supposed to go to Australia, but my father didn't put enough postage on the letter to the man who was supposed to sponsor us. So it didn't go airmail. And we were waiting and waiting and decided he must not want to sponsor us to Australia anymore. And my mother heard, you know, Reagan had opened the border for more families. So she essentially took us to the front of the line. My sister was 7 and I was 2, and she had both of us, and she's like, let us into America. So we ended up in Texas.
It's interesting. So, I mean, to merge this family upbringing with your love of reading fantastical YA stuff.
Yeah.
To get to this particular novel, which is very much rooted, of course, in identity, but it's also interesting because Anya spends a lot of time inside. I'm wondering, you know, how you came to Anya based off of your reading and based off of your personal background. What was it that that really sort of caused her to become this character that you need to pursue in the course of a novel?
Well, I think it's interesting because for myself, I spent a lot of time indoors writing,
yeah.
And I think I decided at age 12 that I was going to be a writer. So I became very serious about wanting to be a writer. And
that meant staying indoors.
Yeah.
Never seeing the sun.
I had many journals.
Only allowed during the hours of like 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. for a brief constitutional.
Yes. Perhaps to play by myself in some kind of a swamp near our house.
To prove that you weren't physically equipped, so therefore, but you were physically equipped to be a writer.
Yes.
Sorry.
Well, I was just really shy. Like, I couldn't talk to people. I had, like, a few friends, but I just was so shy, and I certainly couldn't talk to boys, and I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to... I had, you know, a couple friends, but we had moved a bunch when I was a kid, so I never had those, like, born in the same house, lasting friendships, kind of been in this neighborhood my whole life. So I was definitely a loner, and I used to tag along after my sister, who
yeah.
wanted nothing to do with me. I mean, nothing. So I was sort of the
lost. How did you learn to talk to people?
I think it was in my 20s, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I remember I took classes in high school at Columbia, so I'd take the train.
How to talk to people, yeah.
But I would wander New York by myself.
Uh-huh.
So friends would pair up to go do things in New York, and I would go off by myself, and I would get lost for hours.
Do you still do that to this day sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, I think I prefer to be alone.
Yeah.
So.
Now, this leads me to ask you, I was curious, the depths that you explored Los Angeles. Did you have any stints kicking around L.A. at any time? Or
I lived in L.A. for 10 years.
Okay.
I moved there when I was 18.
That's right.
So, to me, I grew up there.
Yeah.
I know L.A. better than I know Connecticut, which is where I grew up as a kid.
Yeah.
And I was lucky because I met a couple people who were natives, and they were taking me to, like, East L.A. and places nobody really thinks to go. I mean, now Highland Park is cool, but in 98 it wasn't. So
you were determined to find the uncool places.
I was determined to find the places.
The secret places.
The places
that were really just, yeah, square, but actually had something.
The bars that open at 7 a.m.
Exactly.
Those kind of places. That's where I wanted to know. I mean, I was also a huge... At that point, I had discovered Bukowski. So at 18, I discovered Bukowski and John Fante through Bukowski. So I was just obsessed with Los Angeles, obsessed with Bukowski, and obsessed with, like, just essentially being a drifter around L.A.
Yeah.
And in that kind of world. So flop houses and looking for the seedy parts of LA.
The Hollywood Downtowner was that part of these days. It features in the novel.
And it's a real place?
It is a real place. I checked. The website says that it's a haven of tranquility in the heart of Hollywood. Who wouldn't want to go there?
I have driven past it, and I'm not sure if it lives up to the tranquil.
Oh, you've never gone in? You've never actually tried to dip into the pool or anything?
No.
Wow. But so what is your actual knowledge of the Hollywood Downtowner?
I would pass it on. I would walk by on the sidewalk and sort of peek in. So I was always like voyeuristically seeing what other people were doing. And same with apartment buildings. Like I would be staring, walking by and staring in the pool and seeing what everyone was doing. I was also sort of a creeper who would look into people's windows and make up stories about what they were doing.
Did you ever encounter a desk clerk while you were peeping around there? Or?
Not anyone as interesting as a desk clerk that I put into the novel, but I guess I look at people and watch people and make up stories about what they are, what they're doing, who they are, and that's sort of how I operate.
What characteristics of the Downtowner led it to stick in your craw for this particular book? I'm curious. What was it about it that said, hey, you know, this is exactly the kind of place where Anya would go?
Well, it's interesting because Los Angeles is sort of very new, and then a section of it, it's very stuck in like the 60s and 70s, and somehow these two worlds cohabitate, and I just always found those motel hotels that probably were very tranquil in the 60s and great back then and are sort of still trying to hold on interesting with all the atomic signage. And I used to go to the bowling alley where The Big Lebowski was filmed, and it just seemed such like a relic of an old time, and I was so depressed when they tore it down to build a school, but...
There's a bowling alley I'm not going to actually tell you on tape that actually you would love. I'm going to tell you
about. Is it in the Valley? Because I've probably been
there. Actually, it's in Brooklyn.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I'm not going to mention it because I fear that it will be discovered, and I fear that it will be sullied, but it is a time capsule, and it's exactly the kind of thing you would totally dig it. I will let you know off, but...
Yeah, I love those time capsules, because, and I also think about, like, what ghosts inhabit, like, who was there previous to us? So I'm always thinking about what happened here before I got here.
Yes. So what other things did you do? Did you actually plant a tree and have it stolen during this time? What's real and what was sort of invented to get Anya to actually leave the house or have a reason to actually emote or to be active? Carolina has inserted this mattress so she has an object to actually maneuver around. Or there's actually like a stain in the mattress, so now we can actually get a story out of it. So I'm wondering, you know, it's actually very funny. You're so dogged about keeping Anya indoors, and yet you give her these objects, and then it's like, yes, I've got another chapter out of it. Was it sort of like this?
Yeah, I mean, when I lived there, I did live near a Russian gangster hangout.
You did?
There was
a real Twin Palms.
There was a real Twin Palms. And I...
Was there a real Lev?
No.
Okay.
No. I got, you know, some of it's fiction. Most of it's fiction.
Did you know anybody similar to Lev?
Or? No, because I don't talk to people.
I just
watch.
In fact, I had to actually talk to you before we started rolling, so there we go. It's a policy that holds to this day. Sorry.
No, I used to just walk by and again be a creep and watch people.
Wow. And this is how life is now too.
I tend to not interact.
Yeah.
I just like...
You're just the one of the person, like, you go to a bar and you wait for someone to come up and start talking with you.
No, I don't talk back.
You don't talk back? Really?
I usually make...
How do you make friends?
I have a few, but they've been long-term friends.
Oh, I see. What test did they have to pass to get you to talk back?
I'm not impersonable. I'm just...
No, I know, but I'm curious. Believe me, I understand.
They have to be very funny.
Yes.
But the social aspect of it, I always feel like I'm play-acting.
Yeah.
And the people that I don't feel like I'm play-acting with are the ones who tend to stick around.
Do you feel, when you peep around, that you can infer enough based off of what you observe to create a story that's persuasive enough? Do you feel that your imagination somehow translates into fiction better than, say, telling other people, hey, I looked into that guy's window.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the first time I've ever admitted that I stare into people's windows. But I always find that the stories I make up are more interesting than the reality of the situation. So I like to just stick with what I believe is going on rather than getting that the truth of the matter out.
You want a partial snapshot.
Yes. Yeah, I want to get the visual. Yeah. I don't need anything else.
Wow, the money shot. My understanding, though, I mean, I read an interview you did with Roxane Gay.
Yes.
And you said to her that you talked with a number of other people who came to America as young children, and this served as the chief inspiration point for Twin Palms.
Yes.
Now you just said to me that you don't talk with people. What's going on here, Carolina?
Well, I do. There's a couple of friends of mine that actually, one came from Russia, and I, my original idea came from speaking with her, because she came here when she was 8, and she's definitely has more feelings of displacement than even I do. And, you know, speaking with my sister, I speak to my siblings.
Yeah.
And just that feeling of real limbo of not knowing how to behave or interact.
Yeah.
And, and outwardly looking American. I mean, the thing is, my parents have really thick accents, and my sister and I don't. But we come from a different place than other people do. And we don't have this American history that other people have, but we're not that close with our Polish history. So we're kind of without anything, enough of anything.
Well, so who did you talk with aside from family members? Did anybody else? Or?
I have some friends from Russia, and I have another friend who actually came over from Poland in 1991. So she came over here when she was about 12, and her family was different than mine because they really held strong with the Polish culture at home. They only spoke Polish at home. Our house, we only spoke English because my parents were really trying to learn English, and they were, you know, we're in America now and we're American, so let's just let that go.
Yeah.
So it's even interesting among immigrant groups who keeps what and for how long. And, you know, we were close with families in Texas who also came over from Poland, and they, almost all of them speaking Polish at home.
Yeah.
And their English is not as good as my parents, but they're all, you know, professionals. Most of them are engineers, but it's just a totally different upbringing. And, you know, my parents have friends who have decided they're going to move back to Poland to retire, and their mindset is, why did we struggle so much here just for you to go back? It doesn't make any sense. So in our house, it was, that's the past. You're never revisiting the past. It's just move forward, and we're here now. So,
yeah. So you needed to, it seems to me, get some of the information from these stories to fill in what you peeped. You know, what specifically did you get from these conversations that you couldn't get from peeping into windows?
Well, I think, you know, the more personal stories and those conflicted feelings about what it means to be an immigrant, and, you know, a sense of, I think if you totally reject the country you came from, you're sort of ostracized by other immigrants that came here and are holding on. It's sort of feeling of like, do you think you're better than us because you want to be more American than we do, or you're so rejecting where you're from? What's wrong with Poland? Well, there's nothing wrong with Poland, but you know, it's just a different way of trying to survive here. And I think in our house, it was very much, we can't be sentimental about where we came from because it's so hard to be cut off from our entire family being here.
What about the overlap of being ostracized like this from an ethnic identity standpoint, and also from being a young woman? Because many of the things I liked in this book were, for example, Anya's obsession with what she wears, you know, trying to get on the right bra. You know, insights like this are, to some extent, universal and transcend ethnicity, and are all about being a woman and going through these image conscious decisions of how society adorns you or how you're supposed to adorn yourself for society. When you were writing this book, what did you do to kind of make sure that there was enough compartmentalization that was all about Anya's ethnicity and her efforts to become American or Russian or Polish, whatever she felt like, versus these efforts to be a woman?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like they're both a kind of fetishization. And I think what it means to be a woman right now is really a complex matter because, you know, to me, there's this push to, like, the pornoization of women.
Yeah.
And what women have to do now just to be seen by men. And a lot of women really believe they need to do all that, you know, the big boobs and everything. And so that's complicated to me too, because now what does it even mean to be a woman, and how do you get people to become attracted to you in this world where so much of that is skewed, where you just really want to be looked at as an object or noticed, and you think I have to turn myself into an object just to be noticed. And I think in your 20s, you're really, it's a really confusing time to figure out how to be a woman. And I think sometimes you go too over the top because you're just not sure. And I think I've noticed in my 30s a real pulling back of not having to be so, you know, visual about who you are. And I think it's really difficult. It's really difficult to carve out a place for yourself as a woman today.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's always been difficult, but suddenly now I'm getting very, like, motherly about young women saying, stop exploiting yourself. There's enough people trying to exploit you. You don't need to do it to yourself.
Yes. Did Anya allow you to pursue questions of womanhood that, you know, you weren't able to pursue yourself? Did you give her life choices of incidents that you've really wanted to explore but never had the opportunity to, so that you could possibly understand yourself a little bit more as a woman, as being Polish, and so forth?
Sure. I mean, I think the great thing about writing fiction is you make your characters do things you would never do yourself or be a little afraid to, and see how they deal with the choices you're making for them. So, you know, chasing after a man as she does was an interesting thing to me, because she essentially was looking to be controlled by this person. I mean, she had no power in that situation. And I think male-female relationships are really interesting to me as far as the power play is.
But she also does leave him outside of the door waiting.
She does. Anytime she can sort of pull back that power, she does. And to me, I mean, those little moments are when you know, when you can exert your own power.
But it is interesting, because in doing that, it demonstrates that even though it's a rather controlling relationship, she still can, in fact, you know, have a little bit of power to push back that way.
Right, right. I mean, I think there's never a relationship where you're completely powerless.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that men could seem like they have a lot of power and have very little. It's just an idea of perception there. And you have to sort of know yourself well enough and be confident enough to know, you know what, he's not just in control here. I have some say, and I need to play this a little better.
Aside from what we're talking about here, how much did the issue of male power become a serious theme when you were writing this novel, out of curiosity?
I would say, to me, it's who's holding the keys to where you want to go. And to her, she couldn't really waltz into the Twin Palms or be in this new world without having some entrance. And the only way she could see it is on the arm of someone who was powerful. So even that is, it's complicated to me, because, you know, there's plenty of women who do that, so let's see how this plays out in this situation.
Yes. So, HTML Giant Serafinity reviewed this book, she suggested one of the questions that struck her about your book is whether it's possible to separate these many generations of women that came before Anya. But there's also this question of why she really doesn't want to level with her mother. She claims to be working for an employment agency, but she's actually getting unemployment, and she can't tell the truth to her mother about what's really going on. But see, the thing is, it's not just youthful diffidence, though, with this. There's a line you have later in the book, she tried to hide her accent, or maybe I was used to it and couldn't hear it anymore. So, you know, why ultimately do you think Anya does not want to hear her accent or come to grips with her Polish background quite like this? Why does it have to be compared also against America or Russia? It's really fascinating, but I was curious as to how this panned out here.
Well, I think to me, I wanted to deal with a lot of shame issues in the book as well, so male, female shame, shame of where you've come from, and also shame in your own family of sort of being a failure as a woman and a failure as a person, and this feeling of, you know, you have to be a liar to do what you think you want to do because you don't want to let everyone down, generations down, or, you know, what your mother or grandmother think that you should be. And just to, I guess, be a liar in a way to figure out who you are as a person. And so I was really interested that Sarah brought that up because I think it's a fight that you have as a female of like, and I'm sure men as well, but I'm only looking at it from a female.
We're talking about women here. So.
Yeah. what your the generations before you, like, that cross you have to bear, you know? And it's definitely in my home, I heard, what would your grandmother say? Or your grandmother's looking down at you, you know? And so this sense of you have to be on your best behavior because the ghosts of the family are watching over you, which is in some way nice, but also a really heavy burden.
But it's interesting that Anya goes to Mary, this woman who she picks up from the bingo parlor, who is older, who she says, hey, you were hot back in the day. And it's fascinating to me that she's far more comfortable than that, than actually being honest with her mother, that from ethnic shame comes a sort of
female almost, shame.
Well, female shame, but also a kind of homogenized way to compare herself to what she should be as a woman as well. And then, of course, Mary says, well, why aren't you with someone? And this reduces Anya to kind of stuttering and just sitting there and not really having an answer and shaking her head. And she says, I'm trying. So to me, it's really fascinating that she would also compartmentalize the issues here, and I'm wondering, you know, how that came to be, and why you felt, you know, does she feel that she's reflective of a lot of young women of her type, especially because the Polish community in Los Angeles, as I also research, is not nearly as large as I expected it to be.
It's very small.
You were right that there were only two Polish restaurants. I was shocked, like in a restaurant culture.
Yep, two Polish restaurants, one Polish store in Santa Monica, and one Polish church on West Adams, and I think one in Huntington Beach as well.
Yeah. So if it's an exclusive situation, why wouldn't you try to gravitate towards that?
Well, I think even within your own culture, I always felt like there was a sense of not being Polish enough.
Yeah.
There's varying degrees of how Polish are you.
That's kind of like Jewishness.
You know, if you don't speak Polish very well, you're sort of a fraud.
Yeah.
And that was always my mindset. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I think because I came here so young and I was two, I just don't... It's almost fraudulent for me to say I'm Polish.
Why not?
I don't know.
Well, you've had some time. I think you can be absolutely certain on the Polish issue now.
Yes. But to pass myself off as, like, super Polish, I'm going to Polish clubs and have a Polish boyfriend, and, you know...
This is totally like Judaism. My goodness.
It's really interesting to me because I tried when I was a teenager, and I had some Polish friends.
Who said you were Polish enough?
There were a couple girls outside of our group that sort of were like, yeah, you can hardly speak. And so it became like,
wow. Do
I either like go full force and go take Polish classes even though I'm Polish, or just forget this whole thing? So
are there support groups for people who are kind of quasi-Polish?
Not Polish enough.
Should we start them?
I would happily sit there and just hear the grievances of what not being Polish enough is. You know?
I know, I was born there, I mean. You would think that counts. But
yeah.
I think also it's my own personal hang-ups as far as just... I've always had an issue with sort of telling that refugee story just because I was there, but it wasn't necessarily my struggle. So,
yeah.
You know... Going on and on about, you know, what we had to do to leave and everything that was surrounding it. I mean, to me, it's like family stories.
But Carolina, not everybody has that story.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, there are certain similar stories, and maybe this gets into the regrettable memoir culture of, like, have you suffered enough?
Exactly.
Which I think is a bunch of bullshit, quite frankly.
Right. I don't need to exploit myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess is what I'm saying. And
you don't feel it's serious or hardcore enough?
I mean, it was not great.
Yeah.
We had to have like meal tickets and stand in lines and stuff. I mean, it wasn't awesome. And communism.
Imagine if they did that here in Williamsburg. The hipsters, I don't know if they'd even survive. I don't know if they could stand in line.
I don't think so either. But I mean, and you know, communism's terrible. And I go back to Poland and I think, wow, we are so behind the rest of Europe because we had that time that was completely controlled by communists. And even looking, I mean, we did a 25-year, we went back to Poland, our whole family, me, my brother, my sister, my parents, to do a 25-year anniversary, like retracing our steps.
Yeah.
And it was really fascinating. And even when we were at the border crossing, we got all of our passports taken away, and the border patrol guy was read off where we were born.
Wow.
And my father was so angry he would only speak English to him.
Wow.
And it turned into like an hour at the border.
Wow.
Saying, you think you're better than me, kind of situation. And then, you know, again, reading off where we were born, and my brother was born in America, and the border guard was like, well, he's half an American.
Oh, man.
So, I mean...
Why do you think there's been a reticence to explore these really fascinating issues of Polish-American identity in American fiction? I mean, now I really realize that you're working a very unusual angle here, and I'm wondering just why there isn't more of this.
I'm not sure. I mean, I was talking to Gary Steingart, and even when I said, you know what, I think I'm going to try to have her be Russian, Gary was like, okay. I mean, even that is strange because Polish and Russian, they hate each other.
Yeah.
I mean, they do. And so to me, that was like, wow, she's being really bad if she's trying to be Russian. And I remember sort of naively going into a Russian store and saying, like, I'm so happy to be here. I'm Polish.
Yeah.
And, you know, Snickers and get out of here, sort of. So to me, it doesn't make, I mean, it makes sense. And, you know, my parents had to learn Russian in school and had to speak Russian growing up. So there's a lot of history, as we could see even at the soccer game a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
There's a lot of animosity there. But I thought that was interesting too, because, you know, we're neighbors and we do share a lot of the same culture, but it could not be farther apart.
Yeah.
And I was
thinking, it's like nobody wants to share the same common suffering. Is that
right?
What it is? Even though there's actually a lot of commonalities on that end.
Yeah. And you know, I was speaking to someone about Asian culture and thinking, you know, there are some cultural similarities, but there's always this idea of someone's worse one culture's worse than the other. And I found that who's worse, who's more terrible. And I saw that a lot between Russian and Polish cultures as well, of just sort of like, you're trash. No, you're trash. And it's like, everyone
basically,
just calm down.
Cultural comparison is the Four Yorkshire Men sketch from Monty Python. You know that one, right?
I haven't seen that one.
It's the one like, well, oh, that's nothing. You know, I had to go ahead and, you know, go up both ways. You know, that's they're all talking about their common suffering, and each story is increasingly more absurd as they go on. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's Eastern Europe is very fascinating to me, and I would actually like to explore it more on my own and see what's going on there now, because I haven't been there for about 5 years, but we would go every 3 or 4 years when I was growing up.
I want to go back to, we kind of touched the lack of Polish community in Los Angeles. When you were there, how steeped were you in it, aside from getting dissed by these other Polish young ladies? And secondly, you know, has it actually improved or broadened or been more inclusive in the years since? What kind of research did you do for this book?
I hung around Greenpoint a lot, actually.
Yeah.
And I, in Los Angeles, I was frequenting the one Polish store, and I would go to both the Polish restaurants. And there is like a bit of solidarity for sure, but you know, I clearly have hang-ups about even like speaking Polish to people. So I might go to a Polish store and know what everything says, but speak English when ordering.
What is the longest amount of Polish you have spoken recently?
Sentences. I mean, it's pathetic.
Yeah.
It's pathetic. And it makes me sad because I haven't retained much from my parents. But I do, I mean, I love all the food.
Yeah.
I sometimes go to the Polish church on East 7th just to like hang out with the Black Madonna. And I think that's more just from childhood. Because my mother, in the book and in real life, my mother did take me to a lot of Polish churches and spent a lot of time at Częstochowa when we were in Poland. And
did you lie to your mother along similar lines? Or?
Yes.
You don't have to get into it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But, you know, so that to me is important to me because it's part of my childhood.
Yeah.
But I think I've retained what I've wanted to retain, and I could be better. I could be better.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask, did you ever call out numbers in a bingo parlor?
I never called out numbers, but I...
Did you attend bingo parlors?
I liked bingo, yeah.
When was the last time you did that?
I would say maybe 6 months ago, St. Cecilia's in Brooklyn, just down the street, actually had bingo, and it's since closed down. All the bingo in the neighborhood has been closing down.
Wow, the bingo is starting to die?
It's dying, and the poor
really?
Ladies. Yeah, the poor...
Because you're basically having a lot of older people who are going to bingo, and they're dying off, and there aren't people replenishing this.
Well, there's plenty. I mean, the bingo halls would be packed with women, but... I guess they didn't have volunteers to run it. I mean, it's really sad to me because...
I didn't realize there was a bingo parlor crisis. Is it limited just to Brooklyn, or is it actually like...
It seems like it.
Huh.
I mean, because I speak to... I have a few ladies that I speak to on the street, and that was like their one opportunity to leave the house during the week.
Oh, man.
So now they have nowhere to go, and the closest bingo is in Queens. And so...
And that's too far for them to get to.
Too far, yeah.
Wow. So, and it was really just volunteers? I mean, did you find out answers as to why these were cracking down? Or?
I think that... I know it, like, ended sort of in the winter during the inclement weather, and I think, you know, there's all the ride shares that pick up the older people to go. They just didn't want to be going over to St. Cecilia's, I guess. But it's very depressing because now they sort of sit outside and have no socialization except for talking to people who walk by.
That's like Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, except it's bingo alone. My good, yeah, exactly.
No cards, no bingo.
Well, at the risk of possibly moving into similarly depressing territory, I have to ask, because I'm extremely curious, you did not have an agent for this book, and I'm wondering why you felt you could not wait, why you felt the need to push this manuscript out there to publishers that you liked, why you felt the need to basically say, you know, I don't have like a year or two of my life to like try to woo an agent to interest them in my writing. You know, why couldn't you wait? Why did you just go ahead and... I mean, it's happening more and more, I noticed, among young writers. They're just basically saying, well, I can send it to $2 Radio or Soho Press or whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, I would... My mindset is it's just as hard to get an agent to respond to you as it is to get a publisher to respond to you.
Yeah.
So if I was getting nowhere with agents and literally people saying, I don't like her. You're going to have to make her a really likable character, and you really need a plot in here and maybe add a mystery. And and I was thinking, okay, you're clearly missing the point.
Yeah.
And so to me, it was like, why would I be chasing after an advocate who doesn't even get my book?
Who isn't being an advocate from the get-go.
Right. And yeah. If I can do it myself. And, you know, I think in my late 20s, I started really realizing half the battle of writing is getting your stuff out there.
Yeah.
So you need to become a really good advocate for yourself. And I think I can probably sell myself better than someone else can. And in this case, I did. And I had really good, what I thought was a really good query letter, and I just started sending it out to publishers. And I got 3 people to read it, and then $2 Radio emailed me saying they wanted it. And I graduated in October, and they bought it in April. So wow. It was pretty quick.
Huh, interesting. Now, I mean, how many agents, did you try any agents before you did this? Or?
I did. I had sent out 20 query letters. I would say 10 agents never even responded. And Columbia does this mixer, an agent mixer, where they bring in agents.
And very often, nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
Yeah. It's more of an excuse for the agents trying to humor the students.
Right.
The students are trying to kind of like say, well, maybe there might just be a chance for me, but that's really not the way to get an agent.
Right, right. I mean, you know, people did get interest from there, but I didn't. And, you know, there were agents that I was speaking to through Believer who would send us queries and stuff, so I, you know, checked with them to see if they'd be interested. And I just felt like, you know, agents now probably have about 30 clients.
Yeah.
And I had come from LA where I was trying to be a screenwriter and had already done the agent and manager dance to badly.
Yeah.
So I already was very disillusioned. And to me, it's like, okay, even if I get an agent, I'm at the bottom of the heap because I haven't sold anything. And I mean, who am I? So they're not going to be pushing me like I would be pushing me. So
it sounds to me like you resented the idea that you would have to change your characters more than the actual business end, and that's why you went out for alone. For
like this. Well, the feedback I was getting was definitely these people are missing the point.
Yeah,
and I strongly believe, and I have an agent now, but I strongly believe agents want the thing they can sell quickly. I mean,
yeah.
And they don't want to put work into it because they have 30 clients and they have a lot of people querying them. And, you know, that was something I heard. This is going to be a really difficult sell.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, but that's your job.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to be a jerk. But.
Do you think that we're in a period right now because agents are now so impacted with query letters and the need to sell and the need to keep their position in the agency that writing from particular perspectives or quirky voices or eccentric voices or provocative or dangerous or confrontational voices, that these are kind of being lost in the present shuffle?
Absolutely. I think that if they don't see how you can be marketed you're probably not going to get picked up. And honestly, I think you're right. It's more about the bottom line now and sort of being a super agent that keeps their job rather than looking for interesting voices. I mean, that's not across the board. I found agents who do value those voices, but it's not like it was.
Yeah. You know,
I think people are taking less and less chances because the market is so crazy.
Now, when you solicited the blurb from Gary Steingart, I'm sure you must have been aware that he is a rather prolific, one might say even incestuous or pansexual blurber. There's a Tumblr devoted to his collected blurbs. Were you aware of the way that he spread his seed? Was this a consideration when you solicited the man?
I did. I mean, I definitely had known about that, but he was also my thesis professor and the reason I started the book. So I felt like he, of anyone, could understand this book. So I didn't feel that dirty about it.
So are you going to stick with the Polish perspective for future books? I mean, how many voices do you think you have in you?
My main interest is actually women and how women are perceived. So I just finished another book, and it's more. No one is Polish in the book.
Do they come from Eastern Europe?
No Eastern Europeans.
Oh, wow. Taking a big, big stance there.
It's pure WASP.
Yeah. Wow.
I find these shoreline town communities so insulated and fascinating, and I decided to wreak some havoc on their precious world in my book. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that seems a good note to end on, Carolina. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much.